Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
I love my fans, aka the hen house.
Oh my God.
It's Monday, which means it's time for TF3. It's good to have you guys, and a great weekend of football. We had to wait for Arsenal to finish their incredible result against Middlesbrough. Wow, am I right? Joining me on the podcast, Dave.
Hello, hello, hello.
Statman, you've just finished another podcast with the other guy we've got on, Nico.
Cracking podcast.
How are you?
Good. It was a cracker. What did you guys discuss today? What if people want to go hear Dave Talks, the daily statisticians football podcast? What would they hear?
Yeah, the Stat Monday football podcast was Nico joining me. We just spoke a bit about the top race for the championship, the Premier League title. But we also moved on to Italy. We talked about AC Milan, Inter Milan. We finished off, of course, with the Champions League. So lots of fun things to go over if you've got some time spare, 20 minutes a day, go and check that stuff out. Make sure you review it as well. Important, drop a review. Something funny, make me laugh. Make me enjoy my day. That's it, Lawrence.
Make me enjoy my day. Okay, must have missed that invite. Chris, elsewhere, you and I have been watching Championship football.
We have, yeah, it's business end, to use a term. I.e. relegation promotion, it's all up there now. Everything for grabs.
Get it all, the latest news on the hen house. Anyway, let's get down to the result, which was tonight. Arsenal got the win in the end against, it seems now, relegation-bound Middlesbrough. Let's start with Arsenal on this one. Dave, in the end, that three at the back idea that Arsene Wenger came up with worked out quite well. Rob Holding on one side of that, and Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain at right back, right wing.
I think
back.
It was a fluid system. I think it kind of, you know, did break back to a 4-2-3-1 as well as this 3-4-2-1 that Chelsea have been playing all season. On the flip side of that, we've seen how, you know, teams can nullify Chelsea. But what I liked was that he played Olivier Giroud. It's simple, but it's so effective. Olivier Giroud is so underrated in his goal scoring and assisting as a striker in the Premier League in the last three seasons. He's really up there with the great guys. So it's one of these things where, you know, Wenger was playing Welbeck through the middle. He wasn't playing Sanchez through the middle, which was stupid. And he wasn't playing Giroud through the middle. But now he's brought Giroud back into the fold. Giroud's obviously, you know, he's contributing to the side, being a target man and so forth. And the two guys behind him scoring the goals, Meza and, of course, Sanchez, grabbing two very important goals for Arsenal's chase for the top four.
And even more importantly in this one, Aaron Ramsey in midfield, Dave.
I think it's one of those players that it's so weird. You know, look at his performance at the European Championships. The best player, team of the European Championship, Aaron Ramsey. Fantastic performance in Wales is sort of 4-2-1 they were playing out there, similar to what Arsenal played this evening. And again, he was so good, so energetic. And I feel that his drive has been what Arsenal have lacked in central midfield, is someone to win the ball back, someone to pressurise the opposition with Zaka and Coquelin in central midfield. It's a bit flat. It's a bit boring. With Ramsey, you've got someone breaking from those lines, pressurising the ball, getting Arsenal further up the pitch. And I think he did that so well this evening, grabbed that crucial assist for the winner. So Ramsey, for me, a fantastic footballer and a fantastic asset for Arsenal. Arsenal fans maybe think a little bit different about him, which is the interesting part of, obviously, Aaron Ramsey.
Was this partly because of personnel, though, Nico? I mean, you know, really, they only had one trustable centre-back there, who was Lauren Koscielny, and then he was flanked by Holding and Paulista.
Yeah, I think they can. Those players, you know, in that formation and that system, can do a job in what Arsenal tried to achieve in that match, which is break down a team with a low block. Like you mentioned, Oxlade-Chamberlain at right wing back. It's a very attacking formation, and one that looks to stretch those lines and create space as opposed to jam it through there. And although, you know, the first goal came through a brilliant Alexis Sanchez free kick, it was the second goal through Mesut Ozil that allowed them to win the game.
Why play three at the back against Middlesbrough?
So it gives you more options at the back in terms of playing out. And what that does is that it brings, if there's a low block, if there's a lot of players behind the ball from a defensive aspect, and you play the ball more at the back and you have more options at the back, those players have to come forward. There's more space in between the lines. There's more space for your better attacking players to operate in those areas. And thus you have a better chance of getting shots on target. And that's essentially the basic concept as to why a three at the back would be, you know, proved to be a positive thing when playing against teams that are going to pack it in.
Chris, a little bit about Middlesbrough before we move on, or at least back to Arsenal. Middlesbrough got rid of Karanka and obviously brought a lot of people forward from the backroom staff. Karanka saw quite a few of his staff leaving. I think we saw Woodgate come in, and we also saw one of the backroom staff promoted from the youth system. Do you think enough change at Middlesbrough in order for there to be a fight back from relegation, or were we to expect them to be 6 points off?
No, I don't think there's been enough change. I think realistically the playing staff is the biggest issue. Karanka wasn't ideal, and I think it became a bad fit because I think he can be quite impulsive, Karanka, and that group I don't think was as good as he wanted them to be. I think there is this element, and it happens to a few coaches that come from top clubs. Roy Keane's a good example. I think they just get frustrated with the lack of ability compared to what they're used to playing with. And the replacement, Steve Agnew, has done a very admirable job. But I look at that team and I always think you have to judge the spine of a promoted side, because that will tell you realistically where the frailties are. And I think there's a lack of creativity. Gaston Ramirez is too inconsistent to be deemed anything useful. Grant Leadbitter is serviceable, so is Adam Clayton. Same with Forshaw. At the back, I think Gibson's a good defender, and, you know, Guzan or Valdez, whichever one, are serviceable keepers. But there's no one there that I think any team above them would currently want to take for their own team, and that's quite a damning indictment.
Yeah, very good point. It does seem like they're a bit of a bit part team, doesn't it? I mean, if you look at that back line, Chris, is Ayala there, who's a Liverpool Academy player, or someone who's bought by Benitez to sort of come through and be completed by that team? You know, you see Fabio in there as well. Is it really any surprise at this point that they... I mean, it's a bit of a weird one, because you would have hoped they could have attracted more talent. And at the beginning of the season, you were hoping someone like Negredo could lead the line better than he has, despite the goal tonight, obviously.
Yeah, Steve Gibson has put a lot of money into that club. He's invested a lot. It's not a rich area, Middlesbrough, actually. It's probably, I would argue, the poorest of the Premier League clubs from a socioeconomic standpoint. And I think the thing is, it's so easy to just say invest, but you've got to do it intelligently. That's the difficulty. And I think picking up guys like Adama Traore, on paper, they look very shrewd deals, because Traore can carry the ball very well. He's arguably one of the fastest in the league, but his end product is the problem. I think that's the issue, is aside from a few, and Gibson jumped into my head when I was thinking this, it is a little bit island of misfit toys. You've got the likes of Rudiger Stead, Stuart Downing, players that either have already shown that they're really not good enough for the top flight, or players who are on the downward trajectory of their careers. And I think it's a shame, because Middlesbrough have been in the second tier for, I think, 7-8 years, I think, before they came up. A good period. I know they went down with Newcastle in 08-09. So they've been there for a while, and I am a little bit disappointed not to see them attack it a bit more. But I think when you look from a macro perspective, it's easy to see the warning signs there, because Karanka walked out in the midst of their promotion campaign when they went to Charlton. he kind of just stormed off and disappeared, but then came back and everything was fine, in inverted commas. So it is for me, when we talk about promoted teams, it is so much about momentum as well, and how much of a mentality as a team in terms of winning, and how many of your players are serviceable you come up with. Because there are teams who make minimal changes and do absolutely fine. I look at the Newcastle team that came up last time. I think Burnley didn't make a huge amount of changes when they came up. Possibly even Leicester. I think they only picked up really Kante. And we saw the influence he had. So it's not a necessity that you have wholesale change. But I think you have to use the Championship season as a litmus test and say, okay, well, can this person come up with us and stay with us, or do we need to improve?
There's someone who's recently completed a Conte doc. I heard a lot about Allegri and the successor that he was to Antonio Conte, and we'll get on to Conte and his failings this weekend in just a second, or maybe the triumph of Mourinho. But what is interesting, and maybe you're fit to answer this one quite well at this point, Nico, is a lot of people are putting Allegri forward as a great candidate to succeed from Arsene Wenger. And it got me thinking about the way that people see Wenger at the moment, and maybe some of the disrespect that's taken away from the analysis of Wenger. And his game management is quite an interesting one. And it got me thinking about the game management of Allegri. And a lot of people at Juventus seem to very well understand that Allegri is a good game manager. He's someone who tells the players slow down, have patience, not worry. And the fans buy into that. They don't get onto the players' backs for the wrong reasons. And I sort of see Wenger in a similar way. Does it worry you a little bit that people are sort of looking so far forward ahead to Allegri, when actually what they have is already someone who seems quite good at management of a game?
There are certain similarities, like you mentioned, with the game management between Allegri and Arsene Wenger. But I think, you know, like you mentioned, the fans not getting on the back of the players as easily, you know, that comes with the fact that, you know, Conte had serial success with Juventus. Allegri has had serial success with Juventus. So it's not the craziest thing in the world for Allegri to ask for that patience when he's delivered upon it. As you know, for Arsene Wenger, he hasn't necessarily done so. But in terms of game management, there are some parallels. But at the same time, I think Allegri is much better at adapting and sort of modernizing his tactics and those things that make him a great manager, and making those things, you know, better for or relevant to his game management, in a sense, than Arsene Wenger is at the current moment. Because I think where, you know, you and Dave and I have spoken about Juventus 2-0 winning a game in the league this season is a strangulation of the game, and we saw that against Barcelona. Arsene Wenger doesn't have that variation within his tactics to do the same thing. He presses at different parts of the game, and it's all very measured. He sits back and he uses possession in clever ways that doesn't seem to be consistent for Arsene Wenger. You know, he doesn't just get results against certain type of teams. He gets results pretty much against everyone, and that's not only because of his tactics, that's not only because of his game management, but that's because of almost a mastery of what is game state, and probably one of the most important things. And I think that's what separates him from not just Arsene Wenger, but a multitude of managers in Europe this season.
Arsenal still find themselves off the top four, but still very much in contention, Chris?
Of course they're in contention. I think the concern I had with them tonight was, yes, they won the game. I still didn't see a consistency and a control, whether that be physically through strength and winning tackles, or just, again, having control by holding the ball. That's the problem with this Arsenal team. In a number of ways, I don't really know how they play. And I think I look at Wenger at his peak, and I see a coach who had a very clearly defined style that you could articulate very simply. I'm not sure that's true to this day. And that's, for me, a problem that they need to work on, because you look at a lot of the other teams fighting for that spot, and you can clearly define how they play, and you can very much sense the strength in them. Whereas I can't really do that with Arsenal. It's more defined by individuals. It's Alexis, it's Ozil when he feels like it. those are the players that define them, but it's not necessarily the traits.
Interesting. Yeah, I guess we'll see soon. A lot of people praising Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain on Twitter tonight for some post-match comments that he made, basically showing that he understands the situation he's in and that he hasn't necessarily always done what's best for Arsenal. But now he is apparently about playing at right wing back. Fale la gaveta. Correct. Dave, let's talk a little bit about the guy who preceded Allegri at Juve. It's Conte. He went away to Old Trafford and got a 2-0 loss thanks to some ironic pragmatism from the man who preceded him at Chelsea.
Well, you know, Mourinho is the king of pragmatism, and again, he showed why he is the best. He tried and tested this system against Conte's side away in the FA Cup, with Phil Jones pretty much picking up Eden Hazard and man-marking him for, you know, the time until Andreira's red card in that game. It was excellent. Phil Jones was fantastic, kept Hazard very quiet on the United's right, Chelsea's left-hand side. But then when Hazard drifted over to drifted into the centre of the pitch, drifted to the left-hand side of United's system, he got a bit of joy. What, in fact, Mourinho did instead of that against Chelsea in the Premier League was he's put a midfielder on Eden Hazard. And that midfielder is a determined midfielder, a midfielder that's got no praise this season for his dogged work, but his dogged work in a creative sense, his dogged work in a defensive sense, and that is Ander Herrera, who for me has been one of the best central midfielders in the Premier League this season and showed again why he's more complete than N'Golo Kante. Ander Herrera can do it all. He can create, he can score. But what he can do, more importantly, is man-mark, something that's not really in Kante's game. Kante is a ball-winning central midfielder that's very good at pressurising / covering ground. What Ander Herrera showed, you know, his willingness to read the game, his willingness to break the ball up in certain situations, but his willingness to man-mark a man, which is incredible. An incredible display from Mourinho and, of course, Manchester United to play pretty much a 3-4-2. That's 10 players, with Ander Herrera as the plus man, who basically just followed Eden Hazard all over the pitch and nullified Eden Hazard, who's been Chelsea's best creative player this season. And it was a fascinating game, tactically, to see how the game evolved with Conte throwing on Fabregas, then Carrick comes on. It was brilliant. But Mourinho 100% won that game for United, with the help, of course, of Ander Herrera.
Interesting. People again being very critical, though, Dave, of your boy Paul Pogba.
Do they watch football? Lawrence, Paul Pogba has created more chances than any other central midfielder in the Premier League this season. Paul Pogba has completed more passes in the opposition's half that are forward than any other central midfielder in the Premier League, and also any other player. If you didn't see Paul Pogba's worth against Chelsea, you are stupid. The tackle that he made on Chelsea's only counter-attack was one of the best tackles we've seen from Paul Pogba this season. The tackle on Diego Costa when Chelsea were breaking down their right-hand side, Paul Pogba got back, won the tackle. But more impressively with Paul Pogba was his ability to link up with the front two that did so well in the game. That is obviously Jesse Lingard and Marcus Rashford, who caused Chelsea centre-half so much problem, running in behind, stretching them vertically. They didn't have a moment on the ball, but Paul Pogba was the guy that was finding those passes. If you didn't think Paul Pogba played well in that game, should probably just put your TV in the bin and maybe start watching cricket.
Very good point. Yeah, probably. Yeah, just put your TV in the bin. And
or send it to my house, because I'd quite like another TV, to be honest.
Put the entire TV in the trash can. Yeah, that's what you should.
Or just do that thing where you smash it. I've heard that's
with
good.
A hammer.
With a hammer. Although I suppose it is a different effect, but it's not the same as those old TVs, you know, where it would sort of, there's the vacuum in the TV and the, you know, the glass bashes. And
maybe you buy an old TV and you smash it up.
Sure. Just to make, but then what do you do with the new TV you're watching the football on?
Yeah, also been that. But you put that like out quietly.
Sure. You put a VR chip in it so that you can only watch cricket.
Fantastic. I mean, the interesting thing here is, though, Dave, Ander Herrera obviously got that second goal. United would have won it anyway, obviously, but you know, that deflection and the handball don't make your answer about things levelling out over a season.
I think it's one of these things where Ander Herrera was very brave. When he made that interception with his hands.
Right,
let me finish. So it was brave to move away from his designated opponent. His designated opponent was obviously Ander Herrera. Eden Hazard. He was man marking him for the full game. To step out and to be aggressive to press Matic is a brave thing to do. And yes, it hit his arm. His arm was probably in a position that it shouldn't have been in, but it hit his arm. But then you've got to take everything else apart from that. United don't score that goal from the handball. United score that goal because Ander Herrera threads a ball through Gary Cahill and Luiz to Rashford to go home and to finish.
Yes, yeah, but one doesn't happen without the other.
One doesn't happen, but then you've still got to defend that situation. Whether it is unjust, whether it's not right, whether the refereeing is wrong, you still have to defend that next phase. Ander Herrera played that next phase, and Ander Herrera played the perfect pass. Marcus Rashford put the ball in the back of the net. It was 100% correct from the eyes from that situation, from the handball. Chelsea did not defend that at all well. You know, Mourinho did catch out, David Luiz did catch out Gary Cahill. The ball was threaded in between an area where United would have worked on that. United would have grabbed transition, you beat that central midfield press of Matic and Kante, you play those through balls to Rashford. And it was perfect. Yes, it was a small situation in the
Dave,
game.
Dave, it wasn't perfect. It was a handball.
I'm talking about the move afterwards, Lawrence. He didn't handball it to Marcus Rashford, did he? He passed it to Marcus Rashford with his foot.
Yeah, sure. But, I mean, you would see why people are annoyed about that.
And I can understand, but I think it's one of these things where football's football. And
sorry, what?
Apart from, you know, if you don't bring in video referee and you don't bring in this situation where, you know, it'd be a stop-start game, it has to be the judgment of the officials. And the referee was in a perfect position to make that call. He made potentially made the wrong call. But again, it's that second phase. It's the phase of, you know, after that decision. Chelsea didn't defend well. United scored a goal. Full stop.
Right. I don't even know where to start, really. Would the issue be though, Dave, that also is that, would you say that sportsmanlike?
What sportsmanlike? Nah. They don't need sportsmanlike in this day and age. We're too fresh and friendly in this day and age in the Premier League. Oh, Jurgen Klopp plays great football. Oh, Marco Silva's a great foreign manager and all this. We need this Ander Herrera handball stuff still occurring in the Premier League because the rest of his performance deserved that assist. The rest of Ander Herrera's game deserved for him to get on the assist scoreboard as well as him to score because he played so well. So consequently, I think it's fine. For me, whatever. Let's move on, Lawrence.
No, you don't get to decide that. I mean, Nico, as someone who talks about tackling in such a way, surely you must have a feeling about this handball as well. And that absolutely, if you're going to treat tackling in one way, maybe you should treat handballs in an absolute way as well.
In what sense? I mean, obviously it was a handball, but it's something that the referee missed. And though it's obviously an annoyance, it's something that happens, and you can debate a lot. Like, you can say that Chelsea weren't ready for Ander Herrera's ball because half the players were claiming that it was a handball and all these other sort of things. But I don't think to demand that a player, that Ander Herrera, stop the play because he knew that it was a handball, I think that's something that's never going to happen.
So what you're saying is that because Ander Herrera
is a genius.
So Ander Herrera should deliberately. Surely he's misleading the referee. I mean, surely there's an element of misleading.
It depends on what you think happened. Do you think Ander Herrera had nothing, like he didn't know about it and just kind of hit his arm and then he went from there, or you think he purposely hit the ball with his hand and then played the pass? I mean, it depends on what you think. I haven't seen the replay.
I mean, it's also like Dave says, though, isn't it? That the arm was in sort of an unusual position, but then he was running in such a way. I mean, yeah. Would that have been a penalty in the penalty area?
No, not for me. It wasn't in an unusual position because he was running and his arm was like out. When you run, your arm is out. So if you're running and then the ball bounces up from your foot to your hand and then it goes down, that's not an unnatural position.
Right. Well, I mean, yeah. There we go.
Lawrence, I think you lost now, mate. I think that's it. No handball. Great goal. Man United win 2-0.
It's interesting, Dave, that you think that I could win or have lost asking perfectly reasonable questions, but that is...
If you don't understand this, Lawrence, you lost asking those questions, unfortunately, buddy.
Right. Maybe that's indicative.
Capitalism once again is the victor.
I'm not quite sure how Manchester United monetize these. I mean, right. Actually, I'm very sure how handballs can be monetized in football. But less of that, the better.
Shh, we're not sponsored by From Adidas for a reason.
I don't understand what... Dave, are you drunk? Oh, anyway, yeah, Chelsea...
Dave, can you smell toast?
He's not having a stroke, Chris. I think what is interesting here, though, obviously, is that they were without Courtois. Alonso went out in the warm-up. Chelsea didn't cope very well, did they, Chris, with the change environment and with the change in not having Marcus Alonso and also not having Courtois at the back?
Yeah, that was clearly a big change. And I saw a lot of people point to that both from a more sincere avenue and then also people pointing to the fact that, oh, next season will clearly be a massive struggle to Chelsea because, you know, they won't have this consistency that they've been able to foster this season. I think that's a little bit harsh. I think the truth lies in the fact that, yes, there isn't a perhaps strength and depth in Chelsea that there should be. And they have been very fortunate not to be rocked by more injuries or suspensions during the season and maintain that continuity, if you will pardon the pun. I think what will be different for the next season, obviously, you know, John Terry is confirmed as leaving the club this season or at the end of this season. You'll have a lot of loan players come back that I think will actually play a part next season. Guys like Tammy Abraham, Andreas Christensen, I think will come into the fold. Maybe even Charlie Musonda. Just players that will give them that depth that they need without actually having to spend any money. Even possibly Izzy Brown is someone that I think could be quite an interesting choice for Conte to play with. So I think it was unfortunate for Chelsea. I don't think they handled their own style being projected against them, which I don't think they handled very well against Spurs either. Partly because in that instance, I think also the team they were facing had better wing-back options. So there's certainly things for Conte to work on. But then I think even if he'd won the league an absolute canter, which, again, it's still to be decided, obviously, but you have to say he's in a very strong position, he would look at this last 12 months and analyse it critically and say, okay, well, where were we weak? Where can we improve? Because you'd be mad not to. No one stands still, even a team that wins the league.
Conte with Kante at a canter. Certainly would have been an interesting season. Spurs, as you already referenced, Chris, have been referenced by Conte himself as the best team over the last 2 years. It was an unusual comment in a post-match press conference, almost to allude to the fact that Chelsea wouldn't deserve it. Maybe, just maybe, referencing some failures of other managers out there. But I mean, fantastically, and you can also go and see a documentary we made on Pochettino on the Football Republic about why he's got them to this point. But it, again, Nico, it was a consummate performance from Spurs, and they took Bournemouth apart.
Yeah, and I think it was something that was expected of them. And as you said, you know, Mauricio Pochettino's comments are weird, and I think it's one of those things that his English isn't his first language, so maybe the words didn't exactly represent what he said. But I think
it's
one of those performances that exemplifies, you know, how much Mauricio Pochettino has done. As Chris mentioned, I think in the preview to this game, this is one of those matches where we could have seen Benicophobia at 79 minutes and where Spurs slip up, whereas now, under this current evolution and current incarnation of Spurs under Pochettino, we see a completely different team, a team that is ready to face the smaller teams and have the onus of creation, as well as, you know, it does well against the big teams and has a plan for both.
Excellent stuff in this game, Dave, from Spurs. Everything's coming up Spurs house as their players come back. Players are not burning out in the way that we originally thought they might. And, you know, we look at a side who are, again, led by Harry Kane up front.
I think they've done very well to get through this Harry Kane-less period with Son, with Eriksen, with Dele Alli, who have absolutely been fantastic with, obviously, Harry Kane out injured. Harry Kane is all about Spurs. You know, they all, it's all about hitting Harry Kane and playing off Harry Kane and getting your, you know, your attacking players to combine with him. But, you know, this game was another pivotal moment for Harry Kane to be back in with the goals and back in with creating chances, back in with combining with his teammates, got a, grabbed an assist, scored a goal, completed 88% of his passes. It was a fantastic performance from Harry Kane. But if you think of what Dele Alli's done, what Eriksen's done, but more importantly for me against Bournemouth was Moussa Dembele, who completed 64 of his 65 passes against Bournemouth, completing 98.4%, which is incredible. But he scored a goal as well, kept it really ticking over in the centre of the park, which is a very important thing for this Spurs side to keep the ball moving, to keep the opposition moving. And again, Pochettino moved away from the three at the back to a four at the back, played a 4-2-3-1, had Eriksen, Ali and Son combining, and it was... This team is incredible. It really is incredible. It's full of young players, full of hungry players, driven by a manager that plays football the right way. So for me, I'd love Spurs to win the Premier League. It'd just be absolutely fantastic. But again, we've got the last six games where the win rate goes down to 40% under Pochettino at Southampton, at Spurs. It's one of these things where they need to eradicate that. They may have done that by playing a less aggressive style of football over the season, but we will see.
That was next. That was the next thing I was going to reference, actually, Dave, was that run-in has often tripped them up. And the interesting thing was, obviously, that during that run-in last season, the people who tripped them were indeed Chelsea. Even if they probably had fallen, would have fallen short anyway. Chelsea very much got into their heads.
But I think one of the... Sorry, Dave. Go on. I think one of the best things that Pochettino has done, probably one of the most difficult things, is sort of alleviating the pressure and sort of reliance on someone like Moussa Dembele, who has come into I guess the best part of his career in the latter stages, you know, being that central midfield presence, dominating possession and keeping possession in central areas and areas where you're going to be able to take advantage of it, you know, in the best offensive sense, and sort of alleviating that pressure through by changing the formation, by you know, propping up the roles of different players in that team. And not enough can be said about the work he's done in taking the over-reliance away while still making use of that player when they need him to, when they can switch, like you mentioned, Lawrence, from a 3-4-3 or a 4-2-3-1 or many different systems, is having many different answers to a multitude of problems.
It's almost as if we pick just the right managers to cover at just the right time on just the right documentaries. Head over to TFR, that's the Football Republic, not the Front Three, where you can see all of those. And in fact, most of TF3 are on them. It's as if...
Heavy influence, heavy
hit after heavy hit, as Westwood.
It's as if they don't like Americans. It's as if
it's a surprising shift to nepotism on that channel, I find.
Yeah, although Chris's ironic lack of awareness of the nepotism which previously existed on that channel is now kicking me in the face. Anyway, Chris, let's move on, shall we? Although you were a heavy influence on the Conte documentary because you did contribute heavily behind the scenes, and that was barely thanked monetarily. When I say barely, I mean not at all. Anyway, let's move on. Nico
definitely hadn't told me that. Anyway, what a shit way to learn, you know. I'm on the podcast.
Give me another season. Give me another series. Nico, let's come to you, Southampton. Give me another explanation, Nico. Southampton 0, Man City 3.
Yeah, it was a performance that I was, or a game that I was really dreading, because I really do value what Claude Puel has done at Southampton. I think he's been able to deal with a variety of things that haven't gone his way. You know, Virgil van Dijk going out and not necessarily having a striker option at the beginning of the season. Obviously, Gabbiadini has come in and done a job, but even previous to that, he made good use of Charlie Austin. And I've seen them, perform excellent against a similar attacking system in Liverpool, or at least one that creates similar results in sort of their attacking efficacy. But, you know, this game for me really highlighted what is the advantage of playing out of the back. Although the commentators lamented and continually disparaged Manchester City's insistence of playing the ball through Claudio Bravo, it did provide a number of results for Manchester City, who, although they started slow, they were able to capitalize and continue to, I guess, push upon their 1-0 take upon Southampton and get all 3 points in a relatively comfortable performance after about 60 minutes.
Do you think Pep will be disappointed with the position they find themselves in?
No, I think every Manchester City fan was expecting a bit more from Guardiola. He was probably expecting a bit more from himself in terms of his first year. But I think even now, Pep Guardiola doesn't know his best formation, doesn't know the best 11 necessarily. And it's the ceiling hasn't even been close to being reached quite yet. So I'm excited to see what is to come. But I think, yeah, many Manchester City fans and Pep Guardiola himself will be disappointed that they couldn't make a push for maybe further in the Champions League or in the league. But, you know, we're in the latter stages of the FA Cup, which is something that I think is a possibility this season. So if we can get that, that'll be a decent first year for Guardiola.
Pep does make things look so easy when things do finally click. It's just making it click initially, maybe, that some people wanted to trip him up over. Sane, very satisfying on the break. Were you happy for Kompany? Is this sort of a goodbye season?
I would really hope so. The difficult thing about transitioning, like legendary players and players that ultimately the fan base and even
legendary,
those outside of the well, legendary for Manchester City. So like Yaya Toure and Vincent Kompany and David Silva, those players for me will be legendary players for Manchester City because
course,
they'll be
yeah.
the genesis amongst, you know, the generation that has brought the club to where it is and hopefully to where it continues to be. So I think, you know, though Vincent Kompany has done very well under Pep Guardiola when he has gotten the ability to play and has gotten the chance to play, I really hope that we don't struggle and have that old, you know, time of moving on from a player that we all love and really wished had a better time with, had a better, you know, better luck with injuries and such. But it's difficult to imagine that he'll play a major role going forward. And I really hope that the club handles that in the best way.
Yeah, very good point. Let's move on to Liverpool. Yes, another manager made a documentary about. West Brom 0, Liverpool 1 away from home. Roberto Firmino, as they call him in Brazil, Dave, coming good. And he even managed to joke a little bit about taking his own shirt off, just like you.
Well, he has been booked, I think, 7 times in the last 3 seasons or 4 seasons for being excessively celebrating, which, in my opinion, is disgraceful. You know, Firmino needs to understand there's a time to take your shirt off when it's not on that football pitch. But no, Liverpool did well. I think the interesting thing was
you defend
the
handballing, motherfucker, but you will not.
Lawrence, he needs to keep his shirt on, right?
Right.
So we need to say here. But what the interesting part was, obviously, Liverpool scoring from, you know, a crossing position with Firmino standing at 5'11", you know, putting the header into the back of the net following a flick on from Lucas. I think it's an interesting one against the likes of Johnny Evans, McCauley, Craig Dawson. You know, credit to Jurgen Klopp. Jurgen Klopp's obviously potentially worked on something like that to undo the West Brom defence, and it's worked well for Liverpool, and it's got them a massive, massive result. This is huge from Liverpool. This is one of the bogey teams of Liverpool. West Brom in recent years have just had the beating of Liverpool, and you know, to show the character in the side without Sadio Mane as well, who has a cracking conversion rate, who scored the most goals for Liverpool in the Premier League, shows great character in the side, but also Firmino, a Brazilian in form.
Yeah, he really is a Brazilian in form right now. It's also obviously fascinating to see what form he gets out of other players around him and whether that similarly applies to the likes of Felipe Coutinho, who has had some changeable results recently. Liverpool, obviously, without Henderson, Lallana, others, and Daniel Sturridge sitting on the bench. It looks as if his time at the club is now coming to an end, which for a lot of people is very sad. And he was
fantastic.
How do
you feel about that, Lauren?
You know what? I think he's a Premier League. I think he's probably one of those players who will finish his career as one of the maligned players in the Premier League. But he was fantastic for a number of years before he came to Liverpool and will continue to be great when he leaves. He just does not fit with this pressing system, for at least for Jurgen Klopp. And while Jurgen's at the top, you know, I think Daniel Sturridge has to go. I think maybe Liverpool will struggle to find a suitor.
Do you think this result was a bit of a blip on the radar in terms of their ability to get points against the likes of a West Brom or Southampton or teams that maybe they should be beating?
The issue is that a lot of people seem to be full of praise for Simon Mignolet right now, right? I mean, he's made.
I think that's the problem. Is that this is where Manchester City differentiate themselves. Is that where Liverpool have certain tactics and Klopp has certain tactics, and I think this is something that Chris has spoken to. Is that Liverpool specifically, Jurgen Klopp, has yet to really adapt his more tactics to breaking down a team that's going to sit in a low block, and I think a goalkeeper that is better with the ball at his feet can add that dimension to Liverpool where they can pull those teams out as opposed to trying to throw the kitchen sink at it and forcing it through and possibly getting hit on the counter by a West Brom or a Burnley or whoever.
I'd like to see someone, someone with an expected goals model. I know that's not necessarily the only way you can apply it, but would have applied in this game because as Tony Pulis made the point in post-match, it wasn't really the set pieces which brought up the goal opportunities for West Brom in this one. It was actually a series of open play where Liverpool were found wanting, and again, Mignolet kind of coming to Liverpool's rescue. But does that mean he deserves to stay at the end of the season? Probably so. Does that mean bad things for Karius? Possibly. You'd imagine that Karius wants to go and play first-team football elsewhere, and he probably should be allowed to do that. But maybe they'll compete in the summer. Liverpool would have conceded against sides who had better finishing and therefore could have lost 2-1 or even drawn, and that would have been a terrible slip for Liverpool. The issue is for Liverpool, they don't actually have any teams. I don't think they have any top teams who sit in the top six in this final run towards the end of the season. So it's going to be interesting to see. Yeah, looking at Liverpool's fixtures come the end of the season, it just goes Crystal Palace, Watford, Southampton, West Ham, and then Middlesbrough. We sure will see how Liverpool finish the season. But yeah, great. West Brom, I think, look more creative than people give them credit for. And actually, it was quite interesting. I was looking at the ages of this West Brom side after someone in the commentary mentioned that back line was all older than 30, maybe some of them even 35 plus. And I was wondering if maybe when we were talking about the way that Pulis shuts his side down, first of all, they're on course for the best points haul they've ever had in the Premier League. And secondly, with so many people who are aging, maybe part of what Pulis does is maintains his side's fitness, and rather that players don't get injured come the end of the season, rather than push for something that they know that they can realistically not achieve. Just a point. While we're also on Liverpool.
Wait a minute. No, wait, that point. So he's saying that they're over 30. So Craig Dawson is 26. Johnny Evans is 29. Both south of 30, but obviously massively key components in this back four. It just seems obviously it's a throwaway comment from you, Lawrence, but it seems, again, like these people that are commenting on games of football need to do a little bit more research.
Yeah, but I'm also looking at other people. Obviously, there's Gareth McCauley in there, who is...
Obviously, you've got McCauley, who's 36, but then apart from that, the rest of them are a very good age.
Chris Brunt as well, obviously.
But again, Chris Brunt, you know, in terms of a defender, is probably quite young. In terms of, you know,
he's 32.
Played midfield most of his career. He's a young defender at that age. You know, fullbacks can go until they're 34, 35, 36. It's all about Chris Brunt's delivery. That's why he's playing left back for Tony Pulis. Again, it's just missing. It's not a missing.
Fullbacks can go till 36.
Danny Alves, Cafu.
How old is Danny Alves?
He's around 30, I don't know, 30.
He's definitely another side of 30, yeah.
Yeah, and they just absolutely bossed Neymar out of a game, 33 years old.
Well, I mean, also the argument also could go along the lines of Danny Alves is actually more of a right winger than he is a right back for this Juve side.
We're not going to have a right chuckle for the fact they've lamented people's knowledge and then went, Danny Alves is 30.
But Chris, 33 was correct, so in fact I was correct.
Yeah, but you said that with no confidence at all.
No, I was thinking. I was thinking what
shot
age
in the dark.
You can't just jump out with ages. You can't say, you know, Lawrence McKenna is 21 because he's no longer 21. He's actually 23 years old.
But Danny Elvis is not the norm. So, like, I get what you're saying, but I don't think, like, Pablo Zabaleta is as old as Danny Elvis or similar in age.
He looks 15 years ago, mate.
Me, Paul Dummett's going to go until he's 36.
Hope not.
I'm really not looking forward to this.
Well, I mean, all I'm saying is there are a couple of older players in there, and they were looking. A lot of people commenting on the age of those players. I mean, you could also make a converse argument that, you know, look at Maldini or look at Nesta or look at any of these guys who then have the experience and can read the game.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Looking better. But let's see. I mean, you know, he also has a fairly limited squad in that sense.
But when you have an opponent that looks to isolate offensive players versus those fullbacks, you can read the game as well as you like, but it will ultimately come in certain games. It will come down to how quick a player is or, you know, how physical you can be at a certain age.
How good he can be on his feet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's where Pablo Zabaleta has found wanting. That's where Bakary Sagna has been found wanting. That's where Gal Clichy has been found wanting. And those are all players that are younger.
Nico, you're stating terrible fullbacks that recovered from their pace. That was their career is built out of speed. And when they get to a stage where the speed goes, game over.
But a large proportion of the fullback role is having that pace, is getting those crosses in, is being able to cope defensively because attackers are quick. So although you may not necessarily need to be the fastest player in the world to be a left back or a right back, it's certainly a necessary quality to have some degree of pace.
Nico, just admit it. Zabaleta's crocked.
I've said that, but I'm saying Danny Elvis is not the norm.
He's an outlier.
And in many ways, apparently he's an outlier at Juve as well. Anyway, moving on. They're old. I'm going to put it that way. While we're on Liverpool, though, let's talk about Justice for the 96. Liverpool, as a club, also commemorate it this weekend, and credit to all the other sides in the Premier League who also did the same, including Everton and Manchester United, some of Liverpool's closest rivals. It's a weekend to remember, as are most weekends for Liverpool and Liverpool fans as they travel around the country, or also are at home. And it also seems especially pertinent when someone else who was so implicated within besmirching people's names has been such a ridiculous figure again this week. You know, does anyone, I mean, how Calvin McKenzie is still in the press? Actually, I'm not going to go off the back of that because, you know, we don't want to conflate those two issues. But just don't buy the Sun, should we put it that way? Let's move on to Everton, though. Everton won 3-1 at home, Chris, against Burnley. Looking at where Everton can finish themselves this season, they're only 3 points off Manchester United. And they're numerically not out of the top four.
No, they're not. And I also like that Lukaku's goal was a direct copy of a move he showed Jamie Carragher in an interview.
Interesting.
And he said that he basically explained how he holds players off and looks to spin them. And he said, I don't think there's any defender in the league that can stop me when I'm like this. And he proceeded to do exactly that to, I think it was Michael Keane. I think it was him. But yeah, I think Everton are in a a stage of transition. The fact that they're this high in the league while doing it is a great sign. I think they've actually flown a little bit under the radar a little bit, because, again, it is just Coleman's first season. I don't think he's been able to sort of implement the financial muscle that Everton possess quite yet. I mean, he's signed Bolasie, but even still, that was one signing, and actually he's not really felt the benefit of that because Bolasie obviously injured himself for the season. I think as a team, they're a very exciting team. They're a very fun team to watch. I'm curious now to see how they improve, because there's I would say, actually, maybe Lukaku stands alone. After that, I would say there's a lot of players that are of a similar level. So in that instance, you then have to decide, well, okay, what do we prioritise here? Because their defence, I think, looks very solid. You look at Ashley Williams, Mason Holgate has quite a good future. Coleman, when he comes back, Baines again. Then you're looking at the midfield, at Schneiderlin, again, Barkley, McCarthy, etc. It's going to be an interesting task for Coleman in terms of pushing them to the next level and getting them into that potential top four.
A lot of people making good points about Coleman doing very well. Some people on 606 saying that Everton are what Spurs were a few years ago. Could there be an argument made for that, Dave? I mean, you know, the point is that they've been waiting for investment for quite some time. They now have that investment, and apparently they will be given a war chest.
I think that's a load of rubbish. Really do. I think that's just terrible analysis. Once again, Everton as a football club is so far away from what Spurs are doing. Spurs had just got, you know, if we're going to compare it to the start of the Pochettino reign, they just got a hungry manager that had proved massive things at Southampton, at Espanyol.
Coleman's Spurs hungry.
Ronald Koeman had failed at Valencia, failed at Benfica, has done half decent at Southampton, is doing okay with Everton, with a very, very high wage expenditure, with a very high transfer fee. His signings have been terrible. Lukaku's going, who scored 23 goals and got, you know, 24 goals, only got 6 assists. He's been the first player to have been directly involved in 30 Premier League goals this season. He's going to be gone. Everton and Spurs are so, like, it's so far away in terms of North Pole, South Pole. That's what it's kind of like in terms of comparing those two clubs. One club's going the right way, one club's not going the right way, and that's Everton.
But they both have Penguins. Anyway, or do they? I think that is the real footballing question for all of us.
Checkmate.
I will. Anyway, moving on, there are plenty of other great results happening all over Europe. Dave, let's go to Bundesliga real quick, because Borussia Dortmund, who suffered terribly earlier in the week for a number of reasons, both on and off the pitch, both to hugely different degrees, are a team who are currently trying to overcome that. And arguably the result on the pitch can't be at all compared to what happened off it, and it could have been much, much worse. There is a case to be made that they shouldn't even be playing football right now, but they did, and they won 3-1.
Yeah, I think it's a massive thing. You hear what Thomas Tuchel was saying post the Champions League game, where it was someone above that made the decision at Borussia Dortmund. You hear about Berkey's comments before this game against Eintracht Frankfurt. They were sort of saying that every player after the game against Monaco was crying, only UEFA cares about money and so forth. But Dortmund did get the job done on the pitch. They won 3-1. Marco Reus scoring the opener after 3 minutes, you know, coming back from injury, a returning goal. But I think it's all about Christian Pulisic, the positive side of Dortmund at the moment. He's been absolutely fantastic playing this sort of right wing-back role in the 3-4-3, as you call it. And he's just been so composed on the ball, so good at getting forward, and again, grabbed himself an assist. But an all-round had a fantastic performance, linked with the likes of Dembele, Aubameyang, Marco Reus. So it is positive for Dortmund, but again, it's sort of marred by this situation where it seems like this game was forced. The terrible incidents of last Tuesday, there wasn't time for Dortmund as a club, Dortmund as players, to kind of reevaluate what was going on in their lives, and they were just forced to play this game of football. And at the end of the day, life is more important than football. We all love football, we all listen to football, we all watch football, but it's kind of one of these things where it's the decision was wrong. The decision, the game against Monaco should be played this week, not last week.
We're sort of
or maybe even
it's sort
2 weeks,
of,
3 weeks or so. You know, it's so short.
I mean, it's sort of a difficult one, isn't it? Because you know, obviously, there's the situation that it is obviously great to use football as a healer at times. It's also great to use football as a symbol of things. But if it's been the players themselves that have been attacked, you know, it's not as if these people are just are only representing now the symbol of, you know, say when the attacks in France happened, or you know, when something happens, very often people flock towards football. These players themselves were the victims of an attack, and I think, you know, it's almost a similar way to the way that they treat head injuries in football. Is anyone here bleeding? Okay, well then get them to a hospital, and everyone else is fine. It's a bit of a weird one, there hasn't really been a very reasonable solution put forward, has there? Because stopping the actual season itself would obviously be a terrible thing, and you also could put the team in a huge deficit if there is, say, a massive points gap at the top, and they realise what they have to do to, say, achieve a Champions League place or something like that.
I think it's got the both side of it. You've got to have that human side of football. It's a bit strange. Like today, just a random moment, I was having dinner with my girlfriend, and we were talking about like days that she gets off work. She works for a French company in England, and she was talking about a Bastille Day and how she was going to have off work. And I was like, okay, why don't we? You know, it's in June or July. And apologies for the not correct day. I think it's the 14th of July, maybe.
So
why don't we go
to
France? Why don't we go to France and you know, spend the time with your family and just enjoy it there? And obviously, that was the same time that the Nice attacks happened last year. It's one of these weird things where terrorism and these terrible atrocities are now going to get combined with our lives, and we need to be able to deal with these things. We need to give people more time. People are people. You know, you don't know how this is going to affect any of the players that play for Borussia Dortmund. You know, bombs around a bus. Imagine yourself in that situation. It's absolutely terrible. It's going to take you more than half a day to get over that. It may take you weeks, may take you months, but it's just one of these things where football has to have more responsibility in these situations. It has to deal with this a bit better, whether it's UEFA or it's the sponsors or whoever. Somebody needs to stand up and say, this is a little bit wrong. We need to just take a step back. We're just kicking a ball around for 90 minutes. We could do that next week. We can do that the week after. What's more important is the mental health of the likes of, you know, Nuri Sahin, obviously Mark Barcher, Ryan, of course, on the Statman Day Football Podcast. I always get his name wrong, but there's big people there that you need to give them a bit more support. The coaches, the staff, the bus driver and all sorts. That, again, the Champions League, it's glory, the money that it makes. It's a little bit wrong for me. It really is. It's taken the wrong way.
Hmm. Yeah, it's difficult to gauge because a lot of people obviously have suffered through terrorism, and football is very much used as a beacon of hope for a lot of people. I think at this point you see how interconnected and how important to a lot of people football is. It may be cynical to say that they only play because of money. You know, we know after other disasters, people have also been forced to play on. And, you know, not least other people in the Champions League as well. I'm not saying, obviously, it doesn't mean I don't have sympathy for these people who had to play on. And it would be a very different situation, I think, if something, thankfully, which it didn't, but thankfully, if something more terrible had happened on that day. Anyway, let's also go to, Munich drew this weekend against Leverkusen. Most people saying at this point that's academic in terms of the season. But looking at that race to get into Europe, it also feels somewhat academic. Let's go to Serie A now. Nico, you may have discussed this on the Statman Day Football Podcast. Juve got their 2-0 win against Pescara. And Inter drew against AC. AC, of course, with good news this week. They're getting rid of the Illuminati and they're bringing in the Chinese.
Yeah, Berlusconi, the club's most successful managers, or not manager, sorry, owner.
In many ways, he was a manager.
Brought them 5 Champions Leagues, I think, which is over the amount of time that he was there, which is incredible.
I think it's something like 32 trophies in the time he was there. Almost as many as Danny Alves is old, according to Dave.
An insane amount of success under Berlusconi, and now they're under the ownership and financial might, I guess, of a Chinese consortium, which is similar to their crosstown rivals, Inter Milan, who received their financial backing from a Chinese consortium a while ago as well. So it'll be interesting to see how they compete on those fronts and how Serie A sort of comes back from the ebb and flow of different leagues sort of falling out and not necessarily competing on the same financial scale that the Premier League or other leagues around Europe have been able to do for a while. But in terms of the game, is an interesting one. A similar strategy, actually, that Pioli employed to Mourinho in terms of Nagatomo man-marking Suso so that, you know, AC Milan didn't get as much service to their forwards as probably they would have wanted. But, you know, slipping in the latter parts of the game and allowing AC Milan some high-fidelity chances through basically eliminating their press and just going to a low block later in the game is essentially what allowed Milan to come back in the last 17 minutes of the game. Also, a lot of people claiming foul in the sense that there was 5 minutes of extra play and basically 7 minutes were played. So controversy, but at the end of the day, it was a very interesting game. And in terms of the chances, I think it came out even as well. So it's going to be interesting to see how Serie A heats up over the next couple of years.
Yeah, it's going to be fascinating. Why were 7 extra minutes played? Was there any reason why? Was it just sort of...
There was some incidents in the extra time, but the referee really, the interplayers were really complaining that there shouldn't have been that amount of time extra played in extra time. They were obviously upset about it, but AC Milan ecstatic to get the draw.
Yeah, I mean, it is also down to the referee's discretion. The number held up on the board.
And Zapata basically scoring with the last kick of the game. It was the last kick of the game that he got the equalizing goal. So
yeah. Again, though, it is just a recommendation from the referee's assistant. He doesn't have to take that. He can add on. He could add on 15 minutes if he wants.
Very true. Very true. The ref holds the power.
But of course, that would be unusual to add on 15 minutes. Although it has happened. Of course, Locatelli also playing in this game. Or Locatelli playing in this game. Chris, a precocious young talent in Europe and getting the final assist as well for Zapata. It's going to be interesting to see how Italians cope in this team now, isn't it? With all this new investment coming in. Whilst everyone welcomes in the new owners, a lot of Italians are worried that young Italian talent will end up leaving the league because they'll end up importing a lot of players.
Well, that's the thing. The timing of this one is funny in a variety of ways, mostly because Montella had cultivated quite a young, vibrant side. You look at Delafeo, Suso, Locatelli, arguably typifies that, someone that came through the academy like Donnarumma. You would sort of think that moving forward, it is wise to put more faith in that academy because it has, I would say, consistently produced players, if not always for Milan. I think what would perfectly be harmony for Milan in this instance is to use the money that you mentioned there to really kind of accrue the backer type players, the really high level players, but then meld them with the Italians as well. Because I think then you get the perfect blend of, you know, someone like Gattuso, for example. I appreciate he wasn't a graduate of Milan's academy, but he was certainly someone that grasped the club's passion, its history, its ideology, and took that out onto the field, and I think maintained a standard amongst the squad because of that.
Does it put him in the place, Chris, where they can keep hold of a Donnarumma or a young Italian talent? Because obviously there was a lot of talk about Donnarumma being on his way off this summer because that could have funded some vital transfers. But at this point, they've got the investment. They don't necessarily need to sell, especially as they're not in Europe. They're not going to be in Europe, are they?
Well, that's the other thing as well. I think a lot of this will depend on the 10 players that play with Donnarumma. And what I mean by that is it depends how they invest the money. I think for him, the thing is he is still so frighteningly young. He's got such a long career ahead of him. But I think that it can be hard to perhaps have that sense of self-awareness when you are presented with the chance to go to one of these huge clubs, like I think he will be afforded, if not in the summer, then definitely next summer. I also think, though, as well, with instances like that, you look at maybe Lukaku, another good example, albeit not a academy graduate of Everton. You do have to match that ambition for them. You do have to show them that remaining there is beneficial to their career. I really don't think you can just pull out the loyalty card anymore and say, well, you know, you're one of us. So this, I think you do have to match their sporting ambitions. And whether they can do that for Donnarumma, it'll depend how Montella invests that money. I think that's the key thing. There's a lot of money being spent by the elite clubs in Italy at the minute. You look at Juventus, you look at Inter throwing their money around, but it's how you use it and whether you do it intelligently. I think if you look at their rivals Inter, they didn't do it that intelligently when they had the chance to spend. And I think there could be a lot of lessons learned in that respect.
Yeah, very interesting point. Dave, does it worry you at all that the David De Gea rumours are coming back up?
No, I've said before, a goalkeeper at this level, having a goalkeeper of David De Gea's quality isn't as important as having good centre-backs. I think that's something United need to address.
So then surely you're worried about David De Gea leaving?
Not really. I think a solid defence is better than David De Gea, and David De Gea has shown that he wants to leave. Why not let him leave this summer, get a load of money, replace him with a top centre-half and bring another goalkeeper of top quality? And it's simple as anything. But anyway, David De Gea, not too bothered.
But De Gea in the hand is worth... I don't know how that phrase ends.
It's not, though.
Anyway, maybe now I'm actually going to add to Dave's point, and it's a good point. For years, Chelsea built... although they actually also had a really great goalkeeper, so maybe I'm not. For years, Chelsea built on the bedrock that was John Terry at the back. And John Terry is apparently now leaving the club, to which many men on the King's Road breathe a huge sigh of relief. But John Terry himself is very upset about it, Nico, allegedly. And apparently he could be on his way, not joking here, to West Brom. To add to those... plus 30 players that are already at the back.
Could be a good move for them, considering how Tony Pulis likes to use his defenders, and you know how their experience and their combined experience would lead to the furthering of the Pulis ball. But from what I've heard, and maybe we can talk to Chris about this, you know, an MLS move is on the cards.
Good God, Chris.
For old JT?
Yep.
JT.
Apparently, a report via ESPN says sources in the league claim there is no interest in John Terry.
Do you think that makes sense, or do you think that a team in MLS could make some use of him?
No, I don't think so. I think you look at defenders that have made that move, Nesta, Yelly Van Dam, people like that. It's not a terrible move, providing you've got the smarts to make up for the fact you're not very quick. But I think the kind of money he would want, the way I characterise it now, and I get asked a fair amount, would ageing European player, you know, make it an MLS, or would they get a contract? They'd have to take an Ashley Cole contract. And what I mean by that is he's earning, I think, 200,000 at the minute, which is not a huge sum, a relative pittance, actually, when you compare it to European wages.
But all those endorsement deals he must be having.
Well, the thing is, obviously, he's made his money already. And so the benefit for him is the lifestyle, the culture, all that kind of stuff. He might get, you know, kickbacks in other ways. They may pay for his house or whatever. But the actual core salary is very much diminished. And it's a case of this has gone on for years. Players will read in USA Today or whatever, Thierry Henry is on $4 million and Henry is on $6 million, and they think, okay, well, I'm a rung or two down from them, so I should be able to command $1 million, $2 million, and it just doesn't work like that. It's actually reached a stage where I think clubs have become a lot cannier negotiators, that they're not as willing to throw money at anyone, especially an older player. You look at the way the landscape's changed. I think the average age of foreign players that came over in the summer was 26. if memory serves me right, and there was a number of young DPs in there as well, guys like Albert Rusnak, Coleman, Jose Martinez, Miguel Almiron. A lot of clubs now looking at it and saying, yeah, it's great to have the ancillary benefits of marketing and leaving a footprint on the world and getting, you know, ESPN or whoever to reach out and want to do an interview. But really, we need to be winning things. And at the minute, I struggle to see a team in MLS that really needs someone like John Terry. Maybe in a push, Portland, but they've already invested DP money in Liam Ridgewell, who's 31. So I'd be surprised if they went down that route again.
And of course, it would be difficult to tempt John Terry to MLS. He's a man who's famously not very good at taking advantage of the extra lifestyle benefits that are reportedly afforded to a multimillionaire.
Well, he might not want the hassle as well. I mean, this is the thing.
A man also famously who just doesn't want the hassle.
Well, the thing is, when Frank Lampard came over...
of course, to escape John Terry.
One of the first things that was put to him was a very awkward situation that occurred after 9/11, where him and some players got drunk in an airport departure gate and apparently abused some Americans. Now, it's important to state clearly, it wasn't to do with 9/11. It was just the fact they were being drunk and being obnoxious. But obviously the timing of it was seen as quite offensive. And it was something that Frank had to deal with. It was something he had to discuss early on when he came here. And you do have to think the fact that John Terry has a few more of those sort of less than desirable stories at the front of the paper, if you will, means that he might not really want that kind of hassle.
Just Googling Wayne Bridge's location. Wayne Bridge. Huh. He's, yeah. Where is he now? His spouse is Frankie Bridge.
Yes, of S Club Juniors.
Maybe that seems relevant to John. He is no longer playing football, it seems, I think.
His last TV appearance was I'm a Celebrity.
Yeah, he's retired. He played as a left back, I'm informed, reliably. Yeah, turns out Wayne Bridge. Although his salary is, in 2011, £4.68 million. Wow, it's a lot of money.
Not a bad gig if you can get it.
Google also says people also search for Frankie Bridge, John Terry, Ashley Cole, Sean Wright Phillips, and Una Healy, whoever that is. Anyway.
Another member of the Saturday, married to rugby player Ben Foden.
Your nebulous knowledge goes well beyond mine, Chris. How do you know she's married to him?
Just one of them things I know.
Give me another series. Anyway, let's go to Europe again. Let's go back to Europe from across the continent as we preview European football. Let's start with the only English contingent left in the competition, Dave. Atletico Madrid go away to Leicester. Leicester, of course, drawing on the weekend and finding themselves in still a comfortable position within the league. Doesn't look as if they're going to go down at this point. But as Leicester welcome Atletico to the Midlands, do you think they've got a chance?
I don't think so, no. I think Atletico should have more fight, more foot, more determination, especially in central midfield, than Atletico have ever come up against, than Leicester have ever come up against. I think it's one of these things where Atletico have been doing the Leicester City better than Leicester City have done it for a number of years. The likes of Saul and Gabby in central midfield really bossed the show in that first leg, and Didi and Drinkwater. I don't think they've ever felt something so intense, and then you throw in Koke and Carrasco on the wings. It's a very physical central midfield that Leicester City kind of, you know, they haven't really come up against, and I don't think they could deal with that. Jamie Vardy was atrocious in the first leg, and Griezmann was in good form, but wasn't in the classic Antoine Griezmann form, so expect him to come back. Wes Morgan's still out injured, so I can't expect anything else other than an Atletico Madrid win to progress them through to another semi-final.
Diego Godin, of course, Dave, saying that Vardy would fit in to a lot of teams around the world.
I think he would do. I think, it, you know, Simeone said before the first leg that he'd fit into the Atletico side. Maybe this is bringing... This is game. This is sort of gamesmanship in a way. It's playing these head games. Oh, Jamie Vardy could play for us. Jamie Vardy's one of the best players in the world. Is that creating doubt in his own mind? Because he failed to complete a single pass in that first leg. Attempted two, completed zero. So maybe this is Atletico playing these mind games that have just classically worked in European football in the past few decades. So maybe it's Atletico getting one over before the game's even started.
Of course, heading out to Madrid. Are Real Madrid and Bayern Munich, Nico? Of course, in the first leg, it ended 2-1 to Real Madrid, who get those two away goals. Munich find themselves down when they were or could have been in the driving seat. What are you expecting from this one?
I think Real will go through, not because of any sort of tactical or individual brilliance from any sort of player, but you know, Javi Martinez is a huge miss for Bayern Munich, not only because they don't have that many healthy center backs, but because he's an excellent reader of the game. He's an essential part of that formation, and he's, you know, downright just an excellent player. So it's kind of unfortunate that perhaps Carlo Ancelotti's season will be deemed somewhat of a failure, since he won't get past this stage of the Champions League based on the fact that Javi Martinez got a red card. But I'm expecting quite a few goals in this game, but Real still to go through.
Interesting stuff. Chris, on the Wednesday, of course, there are some more fascinating games. Let's start with the one which is maybe the more controversial of the two. But for different reasons. Monaco host Borussia Dortmund. Some people again calling for this game to be at least postponed until a later date. Other people saying the competition must go on for a number of reasons. As hard as it was in the first leg, Dortmund still find themselves very much in this.
I think they do, and that's partly because if we look at Monaco's performance in the knockout rounds so far, they do concede goals as much as they score them. And even in that first leg, there was a few chances, I think, that Dortmund could and possibly should have put away. So it's a situation where, yes, they present a very daunting attacking prospect, Monaco. Mbappe arguably typifies that. Defensively, though, they haven't been as strong. And you look at their performance in the game this weekend, it really wasn't vintage. And so I think it's very probable that if you catch them at the right time and you exploit the space they will, I think, leave in behind those fullbacks, then it's very much a winnable tie for Dortmund. Because, look, this is the thing, the last round, they were very close to going out against Manchester City. It was not as cut and dry as perhaps people would like to convince themselves.
Yeah, very good point. And then, of course, we finish, Dave, on Barcelona at home to Juventus. The ultimate comeback, two matches in a row, or two ties in a row, could be on here. We find, though, that Barcelona are 3-0 down.
They are, but they were 2-0 down to another Allegri side, the AC Milan side of 2013. Barcelona won that second leg 4-0. You know, you can expect Barcelona to do the same thing. This system, if they can get it right, this three at the back, you know, pretty much a five in midfield with Messi and Suarez up top. If they get it right, they'll beat this Juventus team, and it's going to be a fascinating tie, a real fascinating tie, to see if Allegri can do enough in the first few minutes and not do what PSG did and go within themselves and let this Barcelona team dominate.
It's a much more experienced team, though, isn't it, this Juventus side? I mean, much better at game management, much better at
it isn't. You know,
being relaxed.
You saw what they did the last time they got to the Champions League final. Very, very good at game management. But they got beaten that final by the same Barcelona team, by these same Barcelona players. Messi, Neymar, Suarez were playing. Busquets, Iniesta, Rakitic were playing. Piqué was playing. Mascherano was playing. There's a lot of similar players in there. It's like this is a massive mental test for Allegri's management style and, of course, these Juventus players. And it's going to be fascinating to see how they, you know, how they play against this Barcelona team, how they sort of lay themselves out. Are they going to play the classic 4-4-2 defensive shape they're playing, or they're going to drop back to a three at the back. It's going to be a brilliant game.
Am I right in thinking, Dave, that there's a possibility that Paulo Dybala could be out for this one, considering he was taken off with an ankle injury and what is now being reported as a sprained ankle by most people, which could be difficult, because actually he was a huge part of what earned them this 3-0 lead in the first leg.
He was big, very clinical on the counter attack, linked the play very, very well, received the ball in the right areas, drifted from number 10 out wide. But he is one part of this Juventus team. If he's out, it's going to be a massive blow. But it could be a good option to just leave Gonzalo Higuain up top on his own and pack the midfield with midfield runners, the likes of Storaro, the likes of Lamina, you know, players that like to do work, players that like to tackle. Maybe that's a better fit against Barcelona right now than playing someone like Dybala in attacking midfield just for this second leg. They're already 3-0 up. They just need to defend for 90 minutes, and it's simple as that. So maybe packing it with more defenders early doors could be a good option for Allegri.
Yeah, certainly is an interesting one. They started an almost completely different back line on the weekend. Regani and Barzagli starting. Obviously, that meant that Chiellini, Benatia, Alexandro and Dani Alves all didn't play Juventus on the weekend, and then Storaro was the one who came on for Paulo Dybala in the end. It's a fascinating one. Higuain, of course, marches on. He finds himself on a great haul for the first season. Fantastic stuff for Gonzalo and Juventus, who find themselves at the top by 8 points away from Roma, who are the nearest challengers. Dave, do you seriously expect that Barcelona will go through in this one?
I kind of want them to do. I want them to go through. I love what they did against PSG. I loved how they changed that tie around. And tactically, they were fantastic in that second leg. Terrible in the first leg. It was sort of like a performance of two faces in a way, showing the ugly side of Barca, but then showing the beautiful side of Barca. And I kind of want to see that again. I want to see what Allegri does when he's two goals down. Imagine that, right? So the first leg was obviously 3-0. Imagine Barca get a two-goal lead. What does Allegri do? What does Allegri do at 0-0? You know, it's going to be fascinating. And I'd just like to see, you know, I just love Lionel Messi. Lionel Messi's a fantastic, the best footballer we'll ever see in our lifetimes. I just want to see him win more titles where he deserves it, when Manchester United aren't in the Champions League. It's just a fan thing. It really is a fan thing. I've also called Juve at the start of the season of being the dark horses. Weren't really regarded as the dark horses by anybody, but they've now become that, and now they are that. It's one of these things where I like both of these sides, and whoever goes through, I will support them to the final.
It's very committed for someone who wasn't asked for that commitment, but that's fantastic stuff. Chris, elsewhere, obviously on the weekend, Englishmen travel well. And while we finish in Spain, let's go to Granada. Not literally, though it is a lovely place to go. Tony Adams is having great fun over there. A lot of people mocking his training methods. His training ground routine, as some people call it, was mocked on Soccer AM, a show which maybe is about the equivalent relevance of Tony Adams to the modern game. What's going on out there? Because Adams finds himself in an increasingly difficult position with a side who lost 3-0 on the weekend.
He hasn't tried to dress it up, though. He sees himself as an interim boss. He's only there until the end of the season. And, you know, I thought for the first 25 minutes, 28 minutes, that they were not too bad, actually, Granada. They held the ball relatively okay, stifled Celta Vigo a little bit. First went in, second went in, I think, in the second half. And then by the time the third went in, I think they'd had the stuffing knocked out of them. And look, I think people were pretty convinced that Granada were in a lot of trouble before Adams even arrived, so I don't think they were expecting some dramatic turnaround. He's a curious character because as a player, you have the utmost respect for what he did and what he achieved with Arsenal as possibly their greatest ever captain in the modern era. But as a coach, he's I think come across as quite aloof, maybe a little bit lacking in the understanding of the entire team. The one thing I thought about is Granada's side very early on was defensively, at least from the back four. They looked quite strong, actually. They looked quite organised. The line was quite good. the space between the lines actually was relatively impressive. But it was more a case of the attacking elements that I think let them down. They had some decent chances in the second half that if they'd put, I think, one of them away just before that second goal goes in, it's a very different game. Saying all that, I'd be amazed if they stay up. But it's such a hodgepodge team. The mark of the Potsos is still there. I think it was 16 players I counted that are on loan from other clubs. And when you build a squad under that sort of situation, it's nigh impossible, I think, to have any kind of stability or success, because everyone knows, or believes at least, that they're leaving at the end of the season.
Very good point. Now, Chris, take us down to the Championship for just a minute. Brighton go up, obviously, and Newcastle were frustrated, but Huddersfield were also frustrated.
Yes, so we'll start at the top with Brighton, who are in the Premier League now for the first time ever. That was confirmed with the final result of the day, which was Huddersfield drawing at Derby. They've been very consistent, Brighton. I don't think they've been the most exciting team to watch. I actually don't think they have the best individual players of the league either. I think Chris Wood is a more consistent and more of a game changer actually than the Knock or Glenn Murray has turned out to be, because I don't think Leeds are anywhere near that picture without Wood in the team. And yet they've been able to grind out results. They've had a fair bit of luck. I can't deny that, having watched most of their games, sort of questionable penalty decisions here and there, Glenn Murray being quite clever in the box, things of that nature. But I think you have to give a lot of credit to Chris Hughton, because they could have crumbled last year, and I think actually the togetherness they showed was something that they fostered last season and carried with them as a sort of momentum into this new season. And while they weren't the greatest against their rivals near the top, they were beaten by Huddersfield, beaten both home and away by Newcastle, they did manage to consistently pick up points from the lesser teams. And I think that's what's served them most, is their consistency week to week has carried them to the top of the league, and I think will ultimately take them to the title. Closely behind them is Newcastle, who put in a shambolic performance against Ipswich, which were just outdone from start to finish. And they've now got three games left, two at home against Preston and Barnsley, and then one at Cardiff. There's a lot of different permutations here. So the Derby Huddersfield result, Huddersfield went up very early on, and if they'd won that, they would have been just 5 points behind Newcastle with a game in hand and then three to play each respective team. That draw means they're now seven behind with a game to play. And if they don't manage to win against Fulham on Saturday, Newcastle could theoretically be promoted Monday night when they face Preston at home. But at this point, it's a situation that's been the same for Newcastle. It's been in their own hands, but they've just consistently choked. You look at Good Friday, they gave up a goal in the final 10 seconds against Leeds. And then today, they just didn't show up to a man. Jonjo Shelvey, again, very meek, really not the kind of midfielder that is supposedly the best in this league. And I just think for Benitez now, it's a case of getting them over the line, because they have to go up, and then really overacting an overhaul in the summer if they can get up. Then you've got the playoffs, obviously. Looking at realistically Huddersfield, Reading, I think Fulham might sneak in there, and potentially Leeds. Of those teams, I'd say Fulham play the best. Huddersfield have been performing well above expectations, undeniably, but I think Fulham play the best football, and they're the team that I've been most impressed with. At the bottom, you're looking at Wigan, all but down, really. Rotherham already guaranteed of going down as well. Notts Forest in a little bit of trouble, which is a surprise, given we look at their history. And then Blackburn Rovers take up the third relegation spot with three games to go. So there's still a lot to play for at the bottom if the top isn't all but set, because obviously Sheffield Wednesday are in fifth, Fulham sixth, and then Leeds seventh.
Very good point. Well, it's been great to have you guys on tonight's show. Anything you think we've missed from this weekend? We are going to go through the bottom teams when we preview later in the week. But any highlights that we don't think we put in there? I mean, I particularly enjoyed Jalen Shaqiri's goal. And, you know, he seems to be doing well at Stoke.
The overhyping of Ross Barkley and the misanalysis of him.
Interesting stuff. That is interesting. Is that something we can discuss in your podcast?
Tunnel vision.
Yeah, we can do that, Loz.
An English reference there from Dave. We will talk about the teams that are low down in the table later on in the week on the podcast. Adam will be back from Lisbon. He will, of course, be bringing much news of the Portuguese. God knows what. In the meantime, though, Nico, if people want to find you, where can they find you?
Find me on Twitter at @Nico_O'Morales, or find me on Medium at the same address.
I like that. Dave, how about you?
Well, I think you want to go on to iTunes, Statman Dave Football Podcast, and just drop a little review. Something funny, something to entertain me, to get me through the week.
Interesting stuff. Chris?
At the front three.
Excellent stuff. And of course, I'm exactly the same. You can find Adam at Adam Boltwood. Excellent stuff. And we're looking forward to seeing you guys later in the week. There's plenty to come from the front three over the next few months. Where we are getting videos back and up and running real soon. And everything that's going to go on the website, of course, will be fantastic as well. See you again real soon right here on TF3.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.